I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Can cities rebound from disaster? Youngstown Mayor Jay Williams is convinced his city is on the rebound from years of job losses and despair. At 36, he's the city's youngest mayor, and he's determined to turn Youngstown's shrinking city condition into an opportunity. Eugene Birch and Susan Wachter have been looking at disasters of another sort. Their new book is Rebuilding Urban Places After Disaster, Lessons from Hurricane Katrina. We'll talk to Youngstown Mayor Jay Williams along with Jeannie Birch and Susan Wachter about recovering from disaster today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jay Williams is mayor of Youngstown, Ohio. He's the city's first African-American mayor, and at 36, its youngest. He's the first independent candidate to win the mayoral seat in more than 70 years. Prior to resigning from City of Youngstown to run for mayor, he spent 5 years as director of the city's community development agency. Mayor, your admission that Youngstown is a shrinking city was a shock. It's not an admission most mayors would make. Describe what happened in your city since 1962.
Since 1962, and most specifically from the late 1970s, the steel industry in the city of Youngstown in the Mahoning Valley absolutely collapsed. At one point in time, the city of Youngstown and the region were among the top three or four steel-producing regions in the entire United States. In a course of a matter of 5 to 6 months, over 30,000 jobs were lost. So you can imagine the economic devastation, the psychological impact, and it virtually sucked the soul out of the city of Youngstown and the entire region.
And how do you come back from that kind of soul-wrenching experience?
It's difficult, and we are still trying to figure that out. In addition to getting over the psychological impact, there was a paralysis in the community for a number of decades. And because there was such a vacuum, many negative influences stepped in to fill that vacuum, or organized crime being one of the most prominent. So we have finally come to the recognition that this isn't going to be a city of 160,000. And again, it took almost 30 years to come to that recognition and be willing to acknowledge it and do something about it. And as we have acknowledged that, we're trying to figure out how to be a city of 80 or 85,000 that offers a competitive quality of life. We still have some of the assets that we had because we were such once a larger city, and how can we build on those assets and create a community that, again, is able to attract individuals from all walks of life?
I think this notion of being a shrinking city or a smaller city and admitting that to your citizens and to the world, to actually speak its name, if you will, must have taken a lot of courage, because generally speaking, success of cities is easily measured, or frequently measured, perhaps I should say, by growth in population.
You're 100% correct. And this was not just a singular decision or courageous act by one individual. This was a courageous act by the entire community. So often, mayors and administrators measure their cities, as you've indicated, by population size. 100,000 is always a nice benchmark that mayors like to see themselves at or over 500,000. So we figured it was more sensible to try to be a vibrant, economically sound city of 80 or 85,000 as opposed to an ailing city of 115 or 120,000. And again, there are some things that we have to swallow very hard and some difficult decisions that have to be made. So again, all the credit in the world goes to the members of the community who collectively have stepped forward to help make this decision.
And what are some of those difficult decisions?
In terms of providing services, many people who have been in this community for a number of decades remember the level of services that were provided when the city was 150,000. They remember the resources that the city had to take care of social issues and issues that citizens expect their city to take care of. Now, with a shrinking population, we still have the infrastructure. The city of Youngstown is actually laid out to accommodate 250,000 people. At our height, we had about 170,000, so now we've got 80,000. So you can imagine there are still infrastructure costs and burdens that exist. There are acres and acres of the city that are undeveloped or underdeveloped, that we now have slum and blight that we need to remove. So basically, the difficult decisions come about resource allocation and how to provide services to those who are here while still trying to shrink the city and make it much more manageable.
I'm really interested in this issue, Mayor, of how you think about How you think about land in a city, again, that has 80,000 people sitting on land and infrastructure that was built to accommodate 250,000, as you said, accommodated, what, about 166,000, I think, at its peak in 62. So, you know, you've got half the population you had 40 years ago.
Right.
You've got what,
a third of the population that the city could actually hold in its full capacity.
So how do you rethink? I mean, obviously there's some things that have to remain connected. Pipes have to remain connected and streets have to remain connected. But is there a way to think about shrinking the service area?
That's an excellent question and something that is going to take a long and a very difficult time to accomplish. Part of the discussion evolves around the creative use of green space. Parts of the city that were undeveloped, we have to make sure that we allow them to remain undeveloped. We don't want to incentivize development or building in parts of the city that stretch the service areas. Another part of this is trying to, when appropriate and when possible, incent individuals to locate in the more densely populated areas of the city. The city offers rehabilitation services and building services to every citizen, but what we've had to do recently is try to convince the residents that it's no longer in our best interest as a community to continue investing in areas that are just so sparsely populated that it would stretch the service, it would provide inferior service. So we've talked about providing relocation packages. We're not going to force any citizen out via eminent domain or just refusing to provide them services, but no longer can we offer incentives that would cause people to want to build or develop in places of the city that just realistically aren't going to be sustainable to the extent we would like them to be.
How do you do that, Mayor? Do you go door to door? Does your staff go door to door? Do you engage in a personal conversation with these people that for reasons of service efficiency, you would like to see move?
We do it very gingerly. We haven't necessarily gone door to door, but we've engaged in a series of community meetings throughout every neighborhood in the city of Youngstown. And believe me, it's a very politically sensitive topic. There's a lot of sentimentality attached to people who have been in their homes for any number of years. So we are not taking an iron-fisted approach, but what we are saying is that we would like to provide as many incentives as we can to develop the more densely populated areas of the community. If a family or a group of individuals chooses not to move, that's okay. However, when those properties do become available, either through attrition or through some other means, oftentimes we take steps that are appropriate and necessary to make sure that we don't allow those properties to be developed. Some of the housing developers that have in the past developed housing wherever they could find an empty lot in the city, we have now turned policies that said, you know what, before we provide any incentive or assistance to develop, we want to make sure that the development occurs in more densely populated areas of the city. So it's a very ginger approach we have to take, and it's not going to happen overnight because we certainly don't want to force any citizen to do something that they are not comfortable with.
Mayor, you're the youngest mayor that Youngstown has ever had. I think you were 35 when you were elected.
I'm 35 now. I was elected when I was 34, yes.
Do you think your age allows you to be bolder than your predecessors?
I think it does, and for a lot of reasons, because the city I grew up in had already, while I was born in 1971, so the steel mill hadn't collapsed yet, the city was already experiencing a great deal of urban flight. So I am not married to, and I don't have memories of a city that was 160,000 and such a vibrant economic core and a juggernaut. So the memories that I have are a city that had already started a decline but still has a lot of assets, and I think my youth also allows me to be, you know, maybe a little more bold and maybe sometimes a little more foolish, and maybe that's to the to the positive. And I can make decisions and learn from those decisions. And again, I'm not married to some of the past paradigms. So I think it does have an asset. And certainly, you know, there is much that I need to learn, and I take wise counsel. But I think youth in this case does have some advantages.
Do you think that's part of the reason people elected you?
I certainly hope so. Again, I've been virtually a lifelong resident of the city of Youngstown. And we had engaged in this Youngstown 2010 initiative, which I took a personal interest in addition to a professional interest. And I tried to be very honest throughout the campaign about what we could and couldn't do, did not make any unattainable promises. So I think that people are looking for a new way. And I hopefully relate it to the people because, again, maybe I went to school with their sons or their grandsons, and maybe they wanted someone who was going to take a fresh perspective. And, again, who was not in this. If I'm thrown out of office in 4 years for being too bold or too innovative, that's okay because I want to push the envelope while I'm here, but do it in a manner that's respectful of this community.
You mentioned that one of your strategies for shrinkage has to be the creative use of green space, and I'm curious about that. As you've explored strategies for the creative use of green space, what could that look like? What form might that take?
We formed a partnership with the county, a regional council of governments called Lean Forward Ohio, and it's a city-county council that has obtained thousands of acres of tax delinquent property. The county initiated a negotiated lien sale whereby we have now formed this council to help facilitate citizens being able to obtain lots that might be next to them or in their neighborhoods that they wish to maintain for, you know, a very modest sum of money. It's important to try to get those lots back into productive use, and it's much more beneficial to have a neighbor buy the lot for a couple of $100, maintain the lot, maybe expand their front yard or their side yard or their backyard. Also allows us to land bank these lots so they don't fall into the hands of speculators. And again, sometimes we make decisions that this area that was formerly once commercial, industrial, or residential maybe right now is better off used as green space.
Have you thought about urban forestry, urban farming, some of the ideas that have come up in other discussions of shrinking cities?
Those things are part of the discussion. And again, when we talk about the creative uses of those things, it is very, you know, Youngstown is a metropolitan city and the largest municipality in the Mahoning Valley. But there are areas of the city of Youngstown that you and I could go to that you would think that you were in a very rural setting. So we would like to use that to our advantage because within the confines of the city limits, there could very much be some of these urban parks, urban farms. And in fact, there is a very significant urban park in the city of Youngstown, Mill Creek Park, that is a very responsible partner in helping us with the discussion of the use of green space.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Jay Williams. He's mayor of Youngstown, Ohio. Is it possible, do you have the ability to decommission land and return it to the county?
We do have that ability. Youngstown is a charter city, so we have home rule powers, and we can create laws as long as they're not in conflict with state laws. So the partnership that we have formed with the county, I think, would allow that to come into the discussion, and I'm pleased that the county officials are working with us because Youngstown being the county seat, it's important that the two governments work together and coexist peacefully and productively. So, again, there is nothing that we consider so sacred that we can't have a discussion about it. Ultimately, the decisions that are made have to be in the best interest of the community. We realize that everyone might not agree with those decisions, but ultimately we can no longer operate off of a paradigm that, well, this is sacred and can't be discussed, or we can't go down this road and try to look at other alternatives.
You mentioned Youngstown 2010, and 2010 is not far away, 3 years from now, but it serves as the vision for Youngstown. It's something you supported when you worked for the city as head of community development. And I know you now support it as mayor and presume you talked about it during your campaign. How does that show the way forward for Youngstown?
Absolutely. And not only supported it, again, it was the Youngstown 2010 initiative that inspired me to run for mayor, having been involved in that initiative. And that was supposed to be the mayoral platform for anyone who was going to run for mayor because the community had invested so much civic time and trust in it. And
did your opponent make it his platform?
They did not, and that was unfortunate. I had no intention on running for mayor. What we were doing is it was coincidental somewhat that the mayoral election was rolling around the same time that we were completing the first phase of 2010. So what we did is we actually went to all the candidates and asked them to embrace this and was hoping that one of them would. And when they all were somewhat cool to it and figured that we're going to run for mayor the way we've always run for mayor, we became very concerned and disenchanted because we didn't want the community to say, wait a minute, we've invested years of time and trust and energy. Now we see mayoral candidates who aren't even speaking of Youngstown 2010 or are doing it in a patronizing fashion. That's what really inspired me to run.
Interesting. Well, I interrupted you and you were telling me how Youngstown 2010 provides a vision, a positive vision for the community to move forward. Tell me about it.
And you brought up a good point, and a lot of people have asked the question, well, what happens when 2010 gets here? That was a moniker that we adopted and sort of embraced because this process started around the 2000 census. And we had just seen a precipitous drop in the city's population and all the statistical data that comes with the census. So what we decided to do was started looking at the city in 10-year increments. And therefore, we knew that the next national census would be in 2010. And we wanted to measure ourselves between, you know, 1990 and 2000 and 2000 and year 2010. So it's not to say that once we reach 2010, we're done. And I've said time and time again that this is not a destination. Youngstown 2010 is a journey. So we'll evaluate our progress come 2010. And when 2010 gets here, this simply rolls over and becomes Youngstown 2020. The citizens have so much embraced this that they voted in a charter amendment that requires the city to every 10 years evaluate, update, and keep relevant the comprehensive plan that, again, will be Youngstown 2020, Youngstown 2030. So the process never ends, but it allows us to look at the community instead of looking back on our yesteryears to look forward at 10-year increments.
And the content of 2010, how does it move you forward? Where are the new ideas for moving Youngstown forward?
Youngstown 2010 provides a very broad framework upon which lots of other smaller strategic plans will fit. And it's not just about city government. It's about the university. It's about the school system. It's about the business community. It's about the faith-based community. There are so many ways to plug into Youngstown 2010. And we talk about our computer and technology. We look for that plug-and-play. So it provides a broad framework. But what it also allows us to do is when the Youngstown city government makes decisions about resource allocation or municipal ordinances, it allows us to operate from the same game plan, from the same roadmap. So when citizens begin to say, well, why is the city making this decision? We can collectively go to the plan and say, well, this is what we identified as a community. This is the way forward. And that's not to say that it's written in stone and it's not a static plan, but we intend to keep it relevant and updated as we continue to move forward in this community.
You said that you will measure the progress in 2010. How will you measure the progress? What measurements will you use?
There are a lot of benchmarks, and there's an old adage that said what gets measured gets done. Certainly, we're not necessarily looking solely at population because a lot of that is beyond our control. But in terms of we've identified some very specific milestones. The city of Youngstown, as you can imagine, there was a significant amount of blight in the neighborhoods with respect to abandoned houses and abandoned commercial properties. We will measure our ability and our progress in eliminating a lot of that blight. Just last year, we demolished 400 commercial and residential structures, which was about three times the amount we had demolished in previous years. And that's because we had a focus plan. We will measure the economic investment, the city's business parks, brownfield remediation. We will measure the health of the neighborhoods. We'll measure things such as crime rates. So there are some specific benchmarks that we will look at and evaluate as we get to the end of this part of the process.
You've raised the possibility that a smaller city ought to have a smaller government. Surely that has been resisted by other elected officials.
It's interesting, and I commend there are some members of the Youngstown City Council who have stepped forward very boldly and said that we need to take a very long, hard look at the structure of Youngstown City government. Currently, we're operating under seven wards. Some people have floated the idea, does it need to be seven wards, or should it be five wards and two at-large council seats? So in addition to that, redistricting the boundaries, the political boundaries within the city of Youngstown. So I want to commend those other elected officials who have stepped up and said, you know what, it's not about me trying to protect or maintain my particular position. It's about structuring the city government so that it works best for the city for the many years to come.
When you have a community that has gone through such wrenching change economically, and then that, of course, affects families, it affects incomes, it affects everything, how do you regain your balance?
It takes an effort, and that's another good question. Sometimes there's an expectation that city government officials are supposed to do this, and that's just impossible. It takes a collective effort from the faith-based community, from the non-faith-based community, again, from the educational and the business community. There are any number of social issues and family issues that affect inner-city urban life, and the city of Youngstown is not immune to those things. So it's a collective effort, and Youngstown 2010 was designed to do just that. It wasn't just about the government of Youngstown. It was about the community and members of the community, and not only members of the city of Youngstown, but the outline, the greater metropolitan area. There are a number of wonderful suburbs that surround the city of Youngstown, and some of those suburbs are flourishing in many respects. But we have to recognize that those suburbs are no longer going to be able to escape the shadow of the city of Youngstown. And as goes Youngstown, so goes the valley. So I can also say that I'm pleased from the participation and the support that we've gotten from people who actually live in some of the suburbs surrounding Youngstown.
Interesting. Mayor, how do you give people in Youngstown who have, again, suffered through a lot of changes, how do you give them then a positive sense of the future? I'm sure 2010 was certainly part of that, but what is it that the people of Youngstown now see as their future? What are they striving for?
We have to celebrate the successes. There are, despite many of the negative attributes that are often associated with urban life in the city of Youngstown, there are on a daily basis many things that are going on in the city of Youngstown that serve as positive examples. There are many successes. So one of the things that we have to continually remind ourselves are to celebrate the successes of Youngstown, celebrate the assets of Youngstown. celebrate the people of Youngstown. In addition to the very real problems that we continue to face, we have to be honest with people. We have to be genuine about how long this is going to take. The city has been in a state of decline for some 30 years, and we're not going to have a panacea that delivers a state of utopia and blissfulness in just a matter of a handful of years. But I think if we're realistic and honest and at the same time celebrate the successes that exist, people continue to get inspired. And then again, if we have some benchmarks to show the progress that we've made, it encourages people to continue on this long and very difficult journey.
You have a university in Youngstown. I'm curious how you think about retaining your college-educated young people in a city of in any city, not just one that has the history, the recent history of Youngstown, but in any mid-size or smaller community, there naturally would be a limited number of opportunities. How do you think about giving young people a reason to stay in Youngstown?
And Youngstown State University has been, in fact, the major co-convener. They were our co-partner. In fact, I'm on a university campus now, and I'm a graduate of Youngstown State University. They have a vested interest in the viability of this city of Youngstown and of this region, which is why we found them to be such a wonderful partner. And it's been interesting. We've involved the students in this 2010 initiative from the very beginning because they are, as you've indicated, the ones that we want to make sure that we have at least a chance to retain from an employment standpoint, from a social offerings, from a residential opportunity. So by involving young people, hearing their ideas, showing them that this process is about recreating a community that they can compete in, we've been able to do that. And again, that's not to say that we're not going to suffer brain drain and we are going to lose some people to other parts of the country that are growing and flourishing. But more and more people that I've talked to have indicated that they would like to be a part of creating additional opportunities in this community. And there are any number of young people who have taken entrepreneurial risk, have stayed in the community and are doing exceptionally well. And we need to help to continue to build on that success and show and allow them to be the chief evangelist for what's going on in this community.
Where do you begin improving the image of Youngstown beyond the city limits and beyond the region?
You begin, and that's another great question. We begin with the people who live here, and sometimes, and I can say this as a native Youngstowner, we are our own worst enemies. I am continually amazed by people who come from other regions and say, well, you know, we sort of hear about Youngstown, but once you get here, you all don't realize the assets that you have. You don't realize the quality of life that you have here, and that's something that I think that the more people here hear that, that's a message that we need to spread. And then we're taking some very simple steps. I mean, making sure that we're cleaning the city up, making sure that the entrances into and out of the city, you know, are aesthetically pleasing. So in trying to help the people here understand that we've got some assets that we need to build on and stop being so down on Youngstown. And that's not to say, again, that we're not going to acknowledge the very real problems that exist here. But there are much more difficult places to be in this country and in this world than Youngstown and the Mahoning Valley.
When you think about what you've learned both as head of community development and now in your year as mayor, what do you think your experience has to teach other cities, other urban leaders in cities with similar histories and similar circumstances?
That these processes have to be driven and embraced by people in the community. I mean, we oftentimes hear the phrase the grassroots approach, but that is so important because had this process been simply about a bunch of elected officials getting together with a bunch of university officials deciding here's a plan, here's what's best to the community, I think it would have been rejected out of hand and it would have been a flash in the pan and we would have been talking about something else. But the longevity of Youngstown 2010, the credibility of Youngstown 2010, the fact that it's being talked about across this nation is because it has been embraced and taken in by the people in this community, and I think they now see that they have some ownership in it. So that would be the lesson that I would convey if there's any other lesson, is the importance of having that civic trust, civic engagement, and making sure it's sustained throughout the process.
Do you imagine as mayor that during your term of office you will have a chance to define Youngstown with a major initiative or a major amenity or something that would stick in the national psyche?
I do think we have that opportunity, and it's interesting that I haven't met you prior to this, but you've sort of tapped into one of my personal ambitions or hopes for the city, not personal in terms of me as an individual, but I want this city to be one that can be looked upon as the city that absolutely hit rock bottom, that has turned itself around. And again, we're not going to be a Manhattan or Atlanta or Los Angeles, and that's fine. but lessons learned from this city that could be applied and transferred to any community. I want people to say if it can be done in Youngstown, Ohio, it can be done anywhere. And I think that while we have a long way to go, we're well on our way to allowing that to be the legacy, not of Jay Williams, but of the city of Youngstown.
Mayor, I wish you much good luck with your work. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
I appreciate it.
Jay Williams is mayor of Youngstown, Ohio. After a short break, we'll talk with Jeannie Birch and Susan Wachter about their new book, Rebuilding Urban Places After Disaster, Lessons from Hurricane Katrina. And we'll talk to Otis White about one man in Kansas City who is demonstrating the value of perseverance in getting things done in cities. Smart Cities made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, sometimes we both despair about the ability to get things done in cities, and yet there's a man in Kansas City who's going to prove us wrong.
Yeah, he's already proven us wrong. His name is Clay Chastain, and there are two things that you need to know about Clay Chastain to begin with. First of all, he is not a transit planner, but he has single-handedly created a transit system in Kansas City, or at least started the ball rolling on a transit system. The other thing is, he doesn't really live in Kansas City anymore. He did live there at one point. He doesn't anymore. He now lives in sort of a rural part of Virginia. But he has, since 1997, been pushing the idea of creating a light rail system in Kansas City. He has done it through 8 referenda, all of which have gone out into defeat, except for the last one in November. And surprisingly, the voters finally said, you know, this makes sense to us. We're going to do it. And the idea that he has is to build a 27-mile light rail system that runs from downtown to the airport, connects some electric shuttle buses along the way, and this is probably the most fanciful part of it, have an aerial gondola, if you can imagine that, that goes from the old Union Station in downtown up this big steep hill to this beautiful city park that they have in Kansas City. So he's got this whole system mapped. It's pretty much the same thing he's been talking about for 10 years. The voters have always said no. Now they said yes. He says it's going to cost $1 billion, and it, you know, it can be financed by extending a transit sales tax that's already in place. Virtually all of the professionals, transit professionals, the Chamber of Commerce and everything say this is just fantasy, that the federal government's never going to finance it, and the system wouldn't work the way that the voters have just enacted it. But for whatever reason, in Kansas City, they heard about it, they never bought it, they finally bought it. And just an average Joe off the street, this guy is a semi-retired home remodeler, has gotten his dream transit system passed at last.
And will officialdom embrace this now?
Well, in a way, the mayor has said, we'll do our very best to make this thing happen. But virtually everybody who's looked at it has just rolled their eyes and said, this thing is not going to work. It's just the feds will never buy it. This is, interestingly enough, not the first time just an average citizen has enacted something like this. The last time it was in Seattle, it was a cab driver who came up with the idea of let's extend the monorail. If you know Seattle, it has a monorail that's more or less a tourist ride back where the old where the old World's Fair was. And let's extend it throughout the city. And he got the voters to go along with it, and they finally pulled the plug when they finally got the bill for it, which is far more than anybody imagined. But it's not the first time it's happened.
Well, I don't know if the transit system makes any sense for Kansas City, but I have to applaud a citizen who is a semi-retired home remodeler having an idea and pushing it in a way that, with persistence and perseverance, and that the eighth time
he was successful. Maybe that's a lesson for all of us. Otis, we have loved having you on the show. You are retiring from your duty here at Smart City and from your fabulous newsletter that you've produced for many years to do what?
To really focus on one central question, which I've long worked in and have realized that the more I learn about, the less I know, which is how communities change themselves, consciously change themselves. So I'm interested in documenting how that happens, where it's happened, what the results have been, documenting the process by which communities resolve that we must change, come up with some idea for change, and make it happen, and explain it to people so that leaders and citizens in cities around the country can learn how to change their community when they want to.
Which cities will you look to first? Where do you think the stories are?
Well, great question. The model for all of this, the one that we believe has consciously changed itself most dramatically, is Chattanooga, Tennessee. So I'll probably make a visit to Chattanooga real early on to find out, in fact, did Chattanooga consciously and deliberately change itself in the way that it is often said that it did. And then I'm going to look for examples of more specific change around the country.
Otis, I will miss talking with you weekly very much, but I wish you good luck on your work. Whatever you learn will be useful to all of us who care about cities, and keep us posted.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks, Otis.
Eugene Birch is professor and chair of the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of Pennsylvania School of Design. Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Together, they direct the Penn Institute for Urban Research, and they are editors of Rebuilding Urban Places After Disaster, Lessons from Hurricane Katrina. How did you approach the topic of rebuilding? It would be easy to be overwhelmed, as apparently the federal government was.
Yeah, it is. This kind of rebuilding issue is overwhelming because it is an urban area where density issues are key. This is one of our oldest historical cities, so there are issues of culture that need to be addressed. And then the most important, perhaps, is the flooding concerns of the Gulf are long-term and need, obviously, to be addressed along with all of the other rebuilding. And those are long-term rebuilding issues.
Was there an obvious hierarchy for the timetable for rebuilding?
Absolutely. And I'd also like to point out that though this book is focused on New Orleans, the message of the book is that approaches to disaster are generalizable for urban places. So when you're thinking about an urban place that's suffered some sort of catastrophe, such as a hurricane, a flood, a tsunami, a typhoon, or whatever, there are a number of things that you have to do first. The first thing you've got to do is establish some short-term economic aid to the people who've been displaced. The second thing you've got to do is to revive the economy, the regional economy. In the case of New Orleans, it was an export economy, a tourist economy, so they had to address that. Third thing you need to do, and I'm quoting, by the way, from Mark Zandi, one of our writers in the book, the third thing you need to do is to deal with the regulatory and financial exigencies that you have and create some forbearance for some of the rigidities. Fourth thing you've got to do is to rebuild your institutions, rebuild your infrastructure so you can get people moving. Fifth thing you need to do is to provide tax incentives for housing and business. And lastly, particularly when there's been a natural disaster such as this, you've got to get that insurance industry moving again so that you have security and confidence among your investors to go back in there. When you're making choices about how to restart and rebuild the infrastructure, you make choices with regard to securing the infrastructure that's in the most resilient sort of places so that the object here is to create an urban place that's going to survive other kinds of problems that it might face. So you make choices about where you're going to make those investments. In terms of the society and the people who have been displaced, you immediately find ways to deal with their immediate distress, but then you begin thinking about what are some of the structural problems that need to be addressed. And you take this as an advantage. You take this as an opportunity to begin thinking about how you can address reforms in education, how you can reform, as you rebuild the institutions, of course, how you can begin to think about reordering a place that may have been facing some earlier difficulties.
What are the pushes and pulls between immediate restoration and how we might do things differently and better if we take more time?
I think, number one, we have to realize that there is no single answer, that there are multiple disciplines that apply to solving some of these problems. And convening some of the ideas around these issues is extremely important. So we need to consult the appropriate people, whether it's the geologist and the ecological planner, whether it's the cultural historian, whether it's the social worker, whether it's experts in community participation and planning. We need to have a team approach, and you need to get people moving very quickly.
And if I may add, the immediate versus long-term is obviously a critical issue. There are some things that, as Jeannie has gone through, have to be done immediately. Those who have been in harm's way have to be dealt with, and aid has to be provided. And, of course, we have lessons learned for the future in that not doing a particularly good job at all, and hopefully we will have learned. But there is an advantage to considering how to rebuild, and maybe not all the information is there in place. And after other major disasters in the United States and even internationally, there is substantial learning and rethinking about how to rebuild. On the other hand, of course, the longer you wait, the less likely it is practically that people will come back. So there's a tension there. We want to rebuild so that it's rebuilding for sustainability. But on the other hand, how much are we losing of the vitality of the city by doing it slowly and carefully?
How is New Orleans managing that tension?
Very poorly. One issue was and is, perhaps it's being addressed now, the vacuum of leadership, the inability of the community writ large to focus on the fact that it needed to address some key problems immediately. And for a community to do that, that community has to have a leader who's willing to take risks and who's willing to lead. We have examples of this, for example, in New York after 9/11. We had a mayor there who was actually quite unpopular by the end of his term, but he rose to the occasion, provided the leadership around which folks rallied.
But the World Trade Tower site has been very slow to redevelop. So why do you say New York's leadership was so far superior to that of New Orleans?
Well, in part, I think that this is the nature of the event. The 9/11 event was clearly an attack not just on New York, but New York is symbolic of the nation as a whole. And it called on deep reserves. In part, it's also the nature of the institutions of the city itself. New Orleans, of course, is a special city for the United States, but its governance has not been strong. And response to these kinds of all-encompassing events have to be collective, requires collective action on all different levels. So it requires actually a rather, it challenges leadership. It's not, you need to go beyond the normal leadership. You really need extraordinary leadership to be able to pull together the different levels that all have to deliver to make a city viable after such destruction.
And you think New York did that?
Well, certainly the scale of the tragedy, which was much smaller with regard to the physical extent that the place experienced. But one incredibly important thing that occurred within days was the resumption of all the activity on Wall Street and the real insistence on the part of the business community that they needed to show that the city was alive, working, and kicking. And they turned just everything upside down to make that happen. What's happened with regard to the site has been a total tragedy. And that, too, is an example of a failure of leadership.
Carol, the integration of information and the response of getting that information out after 9/11 and getting business activity back on was in some ways perhaps unheralded. But this was extraordinary because the attack was meant to not just physically harm New York, obviously. It was to undermine the national economy, and that did not happen.
Several of the authors in your book write about resilience. What contributes to a city's resilience and its ability to recover?
Well, there's the obvious physical resilience, rebuilding a city in such a manner that it will be less vulnerable to the vagaries of nature. So that's an obvious one. Another area of resilience is thinking about the economics of the city and what it will be important in terms of reviving that economic base. Thirdly, and I'm just following really the outline of our book, begin to think about the displaced and the poor and issues of class and race. And I think this tragedy has made the city contemplate more directly some of these issues. And lastly, having an idea about what kind of place it wants to be when it rebuilds is very important to this building of resilience, coming to a consensus, which is now occurring through the United New Orleans planning process that's being funded by a number of foundations led by the Rockefeller Foundation, is going to go a long way to making this city resilient.
And resilience absolutely requires cooperation across the different levels in government, including the federal level, and there needs to be commitment to rebuilding across the different levels and integration of efforts. What perhaps is part of the resilience, besides the very important ones Jeannie has mentioned, are, of course, the physical and also what are rebuilding, the cultural. It's maybe somewhat of a surprise, I think, how important the cultural gifts of New Orleans to the nation are and have so been recognized, and therefore the national will and the national contributions, not even speaking now of the federal government, to make sure that this cultural gift to the nation is preserved going forward and that we don't lose it. But, of course, the other side of that is resiliency, the basic resiliency, which is the physical resiliency. And that is going to – it's a work in progress. And at the same time, there are long-term environmental concerns that are pulling against resiliency in coastal areas such as New Orleans. But not just New Orleans, also Houston, also, of course, Florida. So these issues of resiliency – have yet to be fully addressed.
You would first ensure a very lively and free-flowing and transparent civic level of civic activity. You would do this in whatever governmental processes that you have regarding, for example, planning decisions or zoning decisions or making decisions about how you spend your capital budget or whatever. You would have a system in your city that had a simple and simple, clear, time-limited way of hearing people's voices, so through the political processes. And then, if I were the god of all of this, I would make sure that there were lots and lots and lots of civic organizations that had an interest in various aspects of the city. And I'm drawing on all the lessons that, again, we learned in New York. I was a very busy and heavy participant in two of the activities, the New York New Visions activity, which was 25 design groups getting together, thinking about what to do, and something called the Civic Alliance, which was brought together all of the civic organizations, whether they were social welfare organizations, design organizations, political organizations, and so forth, to create a means to express what the needs and interests were in the rebuilding of that place. And I think that could only have happened because of the very long heritage that that particular city had of a very active set of civic groups.
Carol, I want to also address, we call this a natural disaster. Of course, it was started as a natural disaster, but really it was a failure of the levees that caused New Orleans to be flooded and inundated. This is man-made. It's not a natural hazard. So, of course, the first response to that is make sure that the protection that is in place in theory is actually in place.
What can be learned from past disasters such as the San Francisco earthquake, the Chicago fire, even the Sri Lankan tsunami?
The major learning in each case was that we were able, in the U.S. examples, to come together and rebuild in a way that was resilient going forward. And I guess the unasked question or the unanswered question is, are we going to be able to rebuild in the same fundamental way that makes resilience an outcome for the New Orleans area, as we did in Chicago, as we did in San Francisco?
But in the San Francisco instance, particularly in the immediate responses to the crises in 1906 and 1985, we had a firm, direct response on the part of the federal government. Federal government instilled order through the Army, actually, in 1906. The federal government supervised the aid, dealt with the displaced, dealt with the rebuilding. There was decision and decisiveness that addressed the immediate issues such that the rebuilding could begin a little more quickly than what we've seen in this last case.
What were the lessons from Hurricane Katrina?
Well, let me just answer that in a conceptual way. Rebuilding a place that just was a firestorm destroyed so that there will no longer going forward be wood building. That's the lessons learned past. For New Orleans, the lesson learns are two, the levees must hold, they must be built to hold. And secondly, the floodplain risk must be understood, and the properties that are rebuilt need to be built in a way that the properties themselves and human life is protected. So that means we need to have the information of where the flood risk is severe. We need to have the information of where they can be protected by strong levees, and we need to know that those levees will be in place.
We also need to have the political will to make the hard decisions that are necessary in building a resilient place. For example, The flood insurance program has elevations that it believes buildings should adhere to when they're rebuilt. We have to adhere to those.
And we have to have updated information of what are those of those elevations. The flood insurance program is underfunded. In fact, the federal government, instead of being the decisive leading role, is now lagging. We don't have that information.
Our memories too short to put those lessons to work?
I think it's not that our memories are too short. I think that anyone who has survived any sort of crisis knows that the first thing that he or she wants to do is to get life back to normal again. And what is getting life back to normal again? In many instances, it's being just like you were before. So what we have to do, and this goes back to your earlier question, is we've got to be thinking now about what are the hazards we're living with, and should we be faced with some sort of crisis, how are we going to address those hazards so that they won't create the sort of problems that we are now facing? In other words, we've got to be thinking about, let's just take the elevations issue, we've got to be putting in place behaviors that will call for building now and in the future in the face of crisis and in ways that are safe.
Eugene Birch and Susan Wachter are co-editors of Rebuilding Urban Places After Disaster, Lessons from Hurricane Katrina. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. With the premiere of Cheers in 1982, Gary Portnoy vocalized what we all feel by singing the refrain, "Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name." This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith gives us a look at the neighborhood where he grew up.
As soon as I was old enough to drive, my mother began to send me out on afternoon errands around town. Every day I would come in from school dreading the prospect of being pressed into service yet again. Not that there was anything dreadful per se about the drugstore or the grocery store or the hardware store or the dry cleaners or the dress shop. It's just that teenagers have different ideas about the best uses of a car or an afternoon. And in my case, different ideas about how to go shopping. For it wasn't as if I was ever able to make quick work of these errands, nor finish them without drawing too much attention to myself. Almost without exception, as soon as I would walk through the door of a store, some adult would ask me if I was Mrs. Smith's son. My mother would have called ahead, asking whoever answered the phone to be on the lookout for me. Dutifully, I would call home to find out what my mother had forgotten to tell me to buy. The only variation on this pattern was the drugstore. The pharmacist there knew my mother well. She called him regularly for advice about the sneezes and sniffles that passed around our house. He even knew my grandmother, the wife of an old country doctor who enjoyed dropping in to engage the pharmacist in long discussions about the merits of the assorted remedies she was taking for her various ailments. So my mother didn't have to ask anybody at the drugstore to be out on the lookout for me. She would just call the pharmacist directly and tell him what she'd forgotten. When I would arrive, the pharmacist was ready to announce to anyone within earshot the revisions to my shopping list. This was a lot more attention than I wanted. But nowadays, it's exactly the kind of attention that I miss. My mother took it for granted that shopping is but another kind of social activity in which people are happy to talk, interact, and be on the lookout for one another. My mother never doubted that these were the kinds of values everybody lived by. So she never hesitated to ask for help or to give it. To this day, I still get a sense of dread whenever I go to the store. Not because I'm worried about unwanted attention, but because I'm never quite certain that my list is complete. And these days, getting the list right is all up to me. No more help from strangers, no more calling home. Life just isn't like that anymore. And that's too bad, because nowadays, as much in society at large as in our shopping, we could all benefit from a place where strangers take our mother's calls and the pharmacist knows us by name. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.